Thank you for coming. Welcome to Condensed Matter Zero course. So this is probably the last course among front-end courses you're going to attend. And the purpose of this course is to familiarize you with the basics of condensed matter. This course is primarily designed for students who never saw either solid state or condensed matter physics before. Because there are quite many students who have purely mathematical backgrounds and who come here to PSI and who never took either solid state physics or at least introductory condensed matter in their universities. But since you're going to have condensed matter as a front end course and you will have to pass interview and there is a certain amount of knowledge you are supposed to have while studying at PSI, this course is aimed at preparing you to take more advanced and to learn more advanced material in condensed matter that will be taught later. For some of the students, this material may be boring and very, very familiar, but the experience shows that students have different backgrounds and the lack of very, very preliminary knowledge regarding condensed matter has been proven some kind of a hurdle for those students. The syllabus of the course was put on the wiki. It was put before. And today we're going to cover the following topics: basic Hamiltonian and simplified models for condensed matter. Then I will do a very quick recap of thermodynamics. So it will be very, very brief because I will just write down the basic formulas and basic thermodynamic potentials. You will have the course in statistical mechanics, and apparently this will be taught by David, and he will devote probably 2-3 lectures deriving the relations between different thermodynamics potentials. So I'm not going to do this in this course, but only state the main results. Then I will consider free particle in a box and periodic boundary conditions, how they are used in condensed matter. Then I will discuss the concept of thermodynamic limit and what the density of states means. And if time permits, I will start talking about thermodynamics of free electron gas. As usual, if you have any questions, so don't hesitate to interrupt me during the lecture and ask at any moment. I will try to clarify all points that you find unclear. The lecture notes will be put on the wiki, but they will be put after the lecture, after each lecture, because I may wish to adjust them, to correct them a little bit based on your questions and your recommendations. So this is just my strategy. Okay, any questions at this point? So if there are no questions, so let's start. The key question that you guys are probably going to ask, what is condensed matter about? The answer is very simple. Condensed matter is devoted to the description of physics containing many particles. For example, solids, gases, liquids. So it does not concern, for example, the motion of the particles, relativistic particles in accelerators, because the basic Hamiltonians in condensed matter have mostly non-relativistic nature. But the important things that the amount of particles in condensed matter systems is enormous, and ideally going to infinity. So let me write down the basic Hamiltonian that describes almost all condensed matter systems. When I say almost all condensed matter systems, I'm mainly talking actually all condensed matter systems will be probably a good definition here. H equal to some, I will explain what those sums means, H divided by 2m, nabla I squared, minus sum over alpha, h bar divided by 2m alpha, nabla alpha squared, minus I will first write down, then explain the meaning of each term in this Hamiltonian. Sum over J alpha, Z alpha E squared, R J minus R large alpha. So this is, you can recognize here the form of the Coulomb interaction, plus sum over different pairs of particles. I will explain in a moment what they are. E squared divided by absolute value of Rj minus Rk. And plus sum over different pairs of alpha and beta, Z alpha, Z beta, E squared, R alpha minus R beta. So what is the meaning of each term? The sum over I, this is the sum over electrons of all possible atoms in the whole condensed matter system. The sum over alpha is the sum over all nuclei. So because each atom consists of nuclei and electrons are moving around those nuclei. But this is ideal, of course. If you have diluted gases, then atoms move almost independently, and we can consider the approximation when electrons belong to each nuclei and move around to one particular nuclei. But in liquids and solid states, typically electrons consider the collective motion in the external, in the fields created by the nuclei. So these are kinetic energies of all electrons. Kinetic energy, sum over kinetic energies, of electrons. Similarly, these are the kinetic energies of nuclei, sum over kinetic energies of nuclei. I will use the abbreviation EL and NUCL. Then, what are these? These are Coulomb interactions, because nuclei are positively charged and electrons are negatively charged. Pay attention to the signs. So this term describes Coulomb interaction between electrons and a nuclei. And these terms, as you can see, describe Coulomb interaction between all possible pairs of electrons, and this term describes Coulomb interaction between all possible pairs of nuclei. So this is interaction. I will write briefly. So electron-electron interaction. And this is nucleus interaction. So E is the charge of electron. And Z alpha E is the charge of nuclei. So the charge of electron is negative, so I will better put here this absolute value. And the charge of nuclear is positive. So these are charges of electrons and nuclei. And we presume that our systems in equilibrium are charge neutral, so we have the condition of charge neutrality. So if we sum over all charges of electrons, then it must be equal to the sum over all charges of nuclei. So this is the condition of charge neutrality. And finally, you can see that this mass is the mass of an electron, and these masses are the masses of nuclei. So m, comma m alpha are masses of electron and nuclei. Okay, very good. So, and the coordinates of electrons and nuclei are described by small r's and large r's. So, ri and large r alpha are the coordinates of electrons and nuclei. Well, typically, we employ the condition while dealing with this Hamiltonian that the mass of electron is much smaller than the masses of nuclei, because nuclei consist of protons and neutrons that have much bigger masses than electrons. So this is the basic Hamiltonian that presumably should describe all possible condensed matter systems and all phenomena observed in condensed matter system. But we can ask a question: can we solve this Hamiltonian? The answer is, yeah.
Why can't you have an external potential?
External, we presume that we can add scalar potential, vector potential, but we presume that we deal with the system in equilibrium that is not put in any external field. Yeah, very, very good question. Yeah, but in principle, of course, we can add this if we consider, say, motion in different fields. So, one last comment is that this Hamiltonian is non-relativistic. It's non-relativistic. I wrote down this in the non-relativistic form. The reason for this is that relativistic effects are, in general, present, of course, but they are negligible for the majorities of phenomena that are of interest to us. For example, there is such a phenomenon as spin-orbit interaction that is not taken into account here. But of course, we could start from the system of relativistic particle and write down the Dirac equation, for example, for many particles. But it's not necessary for us. For the majority of phenomena that are observed in condensed matter systems at low temperatures. So very, very good. So this Hamiltonian can be indeed solved exactly, but modern computational abilities allow for the solution for, say, 10, 20 particles, but not more. While we are having the system of 10 in power 23 particles. So this thing is very essential. And we have to resort to some approximations, trying to come up with the models that can be presumably deduced from these Hamiltonians, but that are much simpler, but nevertheless satisfactory for the description of phenomena in this or that condensed matter system. The last comment related here will be that this basic Hamiltonian should potentially describe quite many condensed matter systems, and I will enumerate the major phenomena that are of interest to us when we talk about condensed matter systems. So H should potentially describe solid liquid gas and transitions between these phases, then it should potentially describe metal, insulator, semiconductor, this set of phenomena is related to transport properties exactly when the system is placed in external field. Then It should describe superconductivity. This is a very interesting phenomenon, and you will most likely learn about this in the regular condensed matter core course. So, and finally, it should describe magnetism. Magnetism is a remarkable phenomenon when we have this situation in materials, when magnetic moments, internal magnetic moments, align in certain directions or forming organized structures. Very, very interesting, but the phenomenon of magnetism can be also described starting from this kind of Hamiltonian. Excellent. So excellent. Any questions at this point?
I have a question.
Yeah.
So when you have to like explicitly put in a magnetic interaction term to describe magnetism from this?
I mean, magnetic interaction term, no, the point is that the under certain approximation, when you investigate this Hamiltonian, that you can obtain the phenomenon of the so-called itinerant magnetism.
Okay.
Itinerant magnetism, but this is later. Yes, itinerant magnetism it can be also obtained using this simplification, of course, to this. Yes?
But the only electromagnetism that's in there is an electrostatic potential.
Right, right, right.
How are you going to get magnetism?
It's a very, very, very good question. It's a very good question. When you take the regular condensed matter course, you will see this. So I don't have time now to discuss this. But believe me, you can. Believe me, you can. But this is later. We can talk about this any moment. Just I will explain if you're interested. Okay, but let me continue. So as I said, we need to come up with some kind of simplifications to make at least some progress. Progress trying to describe real condensed matter systems. And the next section is called simplified models. Simplified models. So the simplest model is the model of free electrons. That do not interact either with each other or with nuclei. Do not interact with each other or nuclei. This is a very simple model, but nevertheless, it is used, and it was used widely, especially in the past, and it is applicable, for example, to describe the phenomena in alkali metals that apparently have the simplest electronic structure. So this is, by all means, the simplest model. And most pleasant to work with. Then, next approximation, single electron approximation. So in this approximation, electrons still do not interact with each other, but move in the effective potential created by nuclei. Electrons do not interact with each other, but move in the crystal potential, or better to say, in the potential created by nuclei. This approximation was developed in the middle of 20th century, and people also used different form of crystal potential, or as I wrote here, the potential created by static nuclei. We assume that the nuclei form the crystal lattice and create periodic potential. So depending on the form of the potential, you can obtain different dispersion laws, different eigenenergies of the Hamiltonian that satisfactorily describe many rather complicated metals, many complicated solids. But still, this approximation, though it's more complicated, so I write this more complicated, this approximation is unable to describe some other phenomena, for example, such as superconductivity. So simply because we assume that electrons do not interact with each other. But in fact, they do, of course. A more complicated approximation, even more complicated, I would say, is the approximation where a nuclei are allowed to move. With moving nuclei. So on top of the fact that electrons move in the periodic potential created by nuclei, we allow nuclei to move themselves. So this is how we come up with the concept of phonons. You will see in the regular condensed matter course what it is. And when we have moving nuclei, when we have excitations of crystal lattice allowing nuclei to move, we effectively allow for the new type of interaction between atoms, between nuclei and electrons. And this interaction is responsible for low temperature superconductivity. This is a more complicated approximation. So, and finally, even more complicated approximation is that electron-electron interactions between different groups of electrons I included explicitly. So these approximations are probably the most complicated and describe the very broad range of phenomena. More complicated approximations. So in this latter approximation, what we basically do, we separate electrons on electrons that are very tightly bound with their nuclei and electrons that can move relatively freely in the whole system. So basically local electrons and free electrons. This approximation, of course, very artificial, but nevertheless, it works. Okay, any questions at this point?
Yeah. What do you mean by different groups?
By the different groups of electrons. So there are electrons that are, whose orbitals are very close to nuclei.
Okay.
So we can approximately assume that they don't move around the crystal, but stay near the nuclei. Of course, this is an approximation because they're quantum mechanical particles, and we cannot, strictly speaking, in the quantum mechanical sense, do this. But if we can consider, say, the quasi-classical approximation, in which we can talk about explicitly the coordinates of quantum mechanical particles, then we can say that the internal electrons stay very, very close to nuclei and should just simply reduce effectively the charge of nuclei. So simply screen it a little bit. And the electrons from the outer shell, say we assume that they hop from place to place, and essentially be belong to the whole crystal. That's what we mean. Any other questions? So okay, then I will go to the next topic, and I will make a brief recap of thermodynamics. Thermodynamics. Quick recap. Here I won't derive anything, but simply state what will be necessary just for the calculations done in this course. Yes?
Will there be lecture notes put online?
Yes. Yeah. So quick recap of the derivation of thermodynamics. So yeah, as I said, you will see the derivations related to thermodynamics in statistical mechanics course. But here I will just list things without any derivation. So many body systems are characterized by the sets of thermodynamic variables that are treated independently from each other. But these thermodynamic variables can themselves be grouped in such a way that the variables in each group are effectively dual to each other. So let me list these thermodynamic variables. First, it's temperature. And essentially dual to it, entropy. Temperature is denoted by letter T, entropy is denoted by letter S. Next pair of variables. Volume. V, or the variable that is dual to it in thermodynamic potential, pressure, P. And finally, chemical potential, mu, and the dual variable is number of particles. N. So one can construct the thermodynamic potentials that contain either pair of these above listed variables. Temperature is used when a system is placed in contact with thermal reservoir, and the system can exchange energy with thermal reservoir. Yeah.
So what exactly do you mean when you say that variables are dual?
Well, you, for example, you can construct a thermodynamic potential called free energy. And free energy is dependent on T, V, and mu. But you can use another potential, such as energy, simply energy, not free energy, where the energy is constructed based on entropy, volume, and chemical potential.
Legendre.
Yeah, exactly, absolutely. You can use the Legendre transformation and use interchangeably thermodynamic potentials. Yeah, absolutely. So temperature is used when the system is placed in contact with thermal reservoir and can exchange energy. But you can also imagine this situation when our current system can have variable number of particles. It is effectively placed in contact with the particle reservoir. That's why we effectively have the last pair of variables. When the number of particles is fixed and our system is not allowed to exchange with the external reservoir in terms of particle, then we can just consider everything as a function of the number of particles n. So the very important function that is used in thermodynamics is the density matrix. Rho that is defined this way. You have our Hamiltonian, you have beta, that is 1 over temperature times Boltzmann constant. Typically, people said Boltzmann constant equal to 1 and measure temperature in units of energy. So rho is equal to e in power minus beta h. And in denominator, you have the trace of e minus beta h. When we talk about trace here, we imply that the eigenvalues of our Hamiltonian are known. And we sum over all possible here eigenvalues of our Hamiltonian. This is what we mean by the trace. This quantity is very important because the thermodynamic variables, the averages, can be computed using the density matrix. So if we have some quantity A, then its average is computed as follows. It's trace of rho times A. For example, entropy, if we know the density matrix, if we know the Hamiltonian, if we know this operator, and because it contains operator H here, it acts as an operator, we can compute entropy equal to minus KB trace of rho log rho. This is just the definition of entropy, how it is computed from the density matrix. The physical meaning of entropy is as follows, that exponent of S divided K by KB is the number of states available in the system. Okay. So we quite often, and not only in statistical mechanics course, but also in condensed matter course, we'll be using the one specific thermodynamic potential, F, that is called free energy. And to compute F, one needs to know the following thing. Z equal to trace of E in power minus beta H. So this object is called the partition function. Partition function. And free energy is computed as minus KBT log Z. So free energy is typically considered as a function of T, V, and N. So taking the trace, we assume that the number of particles in our system is fixed, and the Hamiltonian is formulated for this particular number of particles. So we don't consider this the situation when the system is allowed to exchange with the reservoir in terms of particles. Thus, F is the quantity of temperature, volume, and the number of particles. So one knowing The expression for the free energy, one can write some expressions for other thermodynamic variables. So, for example, entropy is given by the derivative df over dt under constant values of V and N. Then pressure is equal to df over dV. So this variable, this derivative is calculated when we keep temperature and the number of particles constant. And finally, the chemical potential mu is equal to, without minus sign, to df over dN, keeping temperature and V constant. So once again, you will see all those thermodynamic quantities in the statistical mechanics course. So here I just write those down for the purposes of illustration, how knowing this very, very important thermodynamic function called free energy, and it is directly calculated when we have the Hamiltonian, allows us to compute other thermodynamic quantities. Then finally, a very important quantity is the heat capacity, C with subscript V, indicating that we keep the volume constant equal to T times the derivative dS over dT when V and N are constant. So very good, very good. And let me now write down the expressions that are analogous for partition functions and free energy for the situation when the number of particles can change. So when the number of particles is not constant, instead of the partition function, we use so-called grand partition function. That is defined as follows: trace of e in power minus beta h minus mu n. And the trace is taken over the states that have all possible numbers of particles. Grand partition function. And equivalently, one can define the thermodynamic potential as follows: minus kBT times log Z grand. So this is called the grand canonical potential. Grand canonical potential. And again, we can ask a question: what are the variables grand canonical potential depends on? Here we have the major change. We subtract the term mu times n from the Hamiltonian and calculate the trace, assuming that the chemical potential controls the number of particles. So chemical potential must be kept constant, and the trace is taken over all possible states that contain different number of particles m. So n varies, mu is constant. Thus, omega is a function of T, V, and mu. And again, we can say that S is equal to minus d omega over dt, when V and mu are constant, P is equal to minus d omega over dV when T and mu are constant. And the number of particles instead is calculated as the derivative of omega with respect to mu when T and V are kept constants. So these are the basic thermodynamic potential, so free energy and grand canonical potential that will be relevant for this course. Any questions? Okay, because I'm done with this part. This was just a very, very quick recap. You will see the rigorous derivations in the course on statistical mechanics later.
There's a glare at the top.
Huh?
Can you just bring the board down? Just
okay,
sure. Because there's a glare at the top.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah, just if you have any questions or concerns, just don't hesitate to ask. Okay, let's move to the next topic called free fermions in a box. Free fermions in a box. So, as I mentioned, the simplest approximation to the basic Hamiltonian is to treat electrons as free particles and assume that they don't have any charge, that they don't interact with nuclei. They are simply just independent. This is the simplest approximation, but without understanding this approximation, it's not possible to consider more complicated cases. And this is the approximation where the thermodynamic quantities are computed most easily and efficiently. So it is really important to know what happens if we have the system of non-interacting fermions. They can be electrons, they can be just neutrons or protons. So I will talk for simplicity about fermions, but I can use the names electrons and simply power particles. But it is important that they obey the Fermi statistics, not some other statistic. This is the most important thing. They may have spin, for example, electron has spin 1/2, or they can be approximately considered spinless. At this point, it doesn't matter much. So I will use interchangeably the words fermions, particles, and electrons during my presentation. Okay, so if we recall our basic Hamiltonian, then we can write the Schrödinger equation for the wave function that describes the whole system. H psi equal to the sum over, here I will assume that fermions have spin, for simplicity, spin 1/2. Sum over all coordinates of fermions, they are spins. The Hamiltonian writes h bar delta I squared divided by 2m acting on the function, that is the function of all possible coordinates and spins of all electrons. So r1 I will write sigma 1 comma r2 sigma 2, and so forth, Rn, sigma n. This is our Hamiltonian, and This is our wave function. So we know that fermions obey the Pauli exclusion principle. So the general wave function must be anti-symmetric with respect to these variables. And it can be written, for example, as in the form of a slatted determinant. However, I am not going to write this down, but say that the wave function of the full system is constructed when we consider the energy levels of the Hamiltonian that describes the motion of just only one particle. And the Hamiltonian that describes the motion of one particle is very simple. H bar divided by 2m, nabla squared acting on psi equal to epsilon times psi. So we have to solve this very, very simple equation. If we know the energy levels and all possible forms of psi corresponding to these energy levels, we can easily construct the wave function describing the full system. So to solve this equation, of course, we can assume that the particle moves from minus infinity to infinity over the whole space. In this case, this is a very standard simple quantum mechanical problem. But the difference is, in condensed matter, we consider this situation when we put one particle and, as in our case, all the non-interacting particles in a box. So basically, we consider the box let me just write it down like here. Box that has sizes L by L by L. And assume that the motion of our particle is such that it cannot leave this box. So we have to impose certain restrictions on this wave function psi. And what people do, they impose so-called periodic boundary conditions. Impose periodic boundary conditions. So-called PBC. This just means that our functions, our wave function psi, must satisfy, for example, the conditions x plus l comma y comma z equal to psi x y z. And the same for other coordinates. So it should be also equal to psi of x y plus l z and equal to psi of x y z plus l. This is what we mean by periodic boundary conditions. Using these conditions, we come to the conclusion that our energy levels must be somehow quantized. This is in complete analogy with the problem of infinite potential well that you studied in quantum mechanics. So when we impose these boundary conditions, we can write down as a result the solution to our Schrödinger equation. The solution is characterized by the discrete momentum k and it can be written in this form, 1 over square root of v, e in power I k r, with eigenvalue epsilon k equal to h squared k squared divided by 2m. And k assuming the discrete values. K must be equal to 2 pi divided by L times Lx, Ly, Lz, where Lx, Ly, and Lz are all possible integers. And actually, yeah. All possible integers. This is the solution to our Schrödinger equation. So we can say that the eigenfunctions and eigenvalues are distinguished by all possible values of this momenta written in this form. Any questions at this point? Yeah.
So like the physical requirement is that any like observables should be periodic functions in the
right
some like three-dimensional time
right
space, right.
Right.
So then why do we impose that like psi has to be symmetric under or invariant under shifts when the physical constraint is that psi squared has to be, like, shouldn't there be room for a phase there?
It's a very good question. Room for a phase.
Yeah.
Right. But here we don't impose. So of course. So you are talking. I will talk later about the so-called Bloch's theorem while moving in the p-periodic potential. The physical requirement is slightly different here. Let's put forward this way. Phase does not enter this conditions here. Yeah.
And if have we imposed that the function vanishes at the boundary of the box?
It's also a very good question. I thought so. If you put, for example, r equal to zero, then the function does not vanish. But a very good thing is that in the thermodynamic limit, if it is normalized by one over v square root of v, if we take v going to zero, then that we or sorry v going to infinity, then we will see that the function vanishes. It's a bit tricky thing. The good thing that all this picture means only in the thermodynamic limit when L goes to infinity itself. So this requirement of vanishing function then automatically becomes irrelevant. So we assume that L is large and ideally stretching the whole space. So this is probably the reason why phase is not very, very important in such a definition. So it's an artificial trick. We first assume that this system occupies a box, and then imagine that box is infinitely large. This is how we recover the motion in the whole space. This is what indeed people do when they consider condensed matter system. That is quite different from what people do in high energy physics. And in high energy physics, they from the very beginning assume that particle occupies the whole space and move from minus infinity to infinity. Here, for the calculational purposes, it is convenient to adopt this scheme. First, we assume box, and then assume that this box is infinitely large. So I already went to my next concept, the concept of thermodynamic limit and the density of state. Excellent. Okay, I'm sorry. Okay. Okay. So, yeah, no problem. Thermodynamic limit. Okay. and energy density of states. So what happens in this picture when L goes to infinity? If L goes to infinity, then the distance between neighboring values of epsilon k goes to zero. Very, very simple. We have that epsilon as a function, say, of kx plus 2 pi over L, say Lx, comma ky, kz minus epsilon of kx, ky, kz divided by epsilon kx, ky, kz, it goes to zero. It tends to zero. So this just means that when we compute the thermodynamic quantities that require the summation over, for example, different values of epsilon k or some other quantities that contain k, we can switch from summation over discrete values of k to the integration. And the purpose of this section is simply to explain how this can be done. Yeah.
I'm just confused as to the interpretation of this, because I thought that the mid board right there is basically saying that, like, if you have a free particle and you say that your space is translationally invariant,
uh-huh,
translations
uh-huh
of L,
uh-huh,
then, like, that's like saying you have the free electron model in a lattice, right?
Approximately.
So
well,
it's like your unit cell size. So then, like, we should expect that.
One second. So. We consider the particle moving in a box with periodic boundary conditions, but we assume that eventually we take the limit when the size of the box goes to infinity. We assume that it's not in some kind of a periodic lattice, because we assume that there is nothing beyond this box.
But isn't that that's what periodic boundary conditions assume, though? That there are copies of that box all around it. And
right.
Tile all of space.
Right. But then we can do the following. We can assume that we concentrate on only one box and discard all other boxes and assume that this box tending to infinity.
Is that the point, that it doesn't matter what happens at the boundaries because you're going to take the volume of your system to infinity?
Exactly. This doesn't matter. This is just for the calculational simplicity.
Yeah. So we shouldn't hang on to an interpretation of what happens at the boundaries because it doesn't matter.
Yeah. It doesn't matter. Exactly. Yes. Yeah. So there are by the way, some problems that are say related to, especially nowadays when people study calculations of entanglement entropy, they for calculational simplicity impose anti-periodic boundary conditions, but then make a statement that in the thermodynamic limit everything should be the same. So suppose we have some quantity f that is a function of k, and we need to compute the sum and need to compute the sum of all possible k, basically the of f of k. Basically we compute the sum over all possible discrete values of k for all possible integers Lx, Ly, and Lz. But we need to do this in the thermodynamic limit. So the question is, can we compute this in a simpler way rather than doing the complicated discrete sum? Can we reduce the summation over discrete k's to integration? And the answer is yes. So let's consider the volume of phase space the infinitesimal volume in the space of all k, dkx, dky times dkz. So what it is in the thermodynamic limit? When L goes to infinity, then the distance between neighboring value of k's is very, very small. So we can write that, that this is, so that d, using dki is approximately following from this definition, 2 pi divided by L times delta Li. So when L goes to infinity, we can substitute delta ki by dki. This is the consequence of going to the thermodynamic limit. And delta Li is simply equal to 1. Is simply equal to 1. So when we have this product, we have d3k equal to 2 pi cubed over v, and delta Lx, delta Ly, delta Lz. But this is 1. So we can write that, that this sum over discrete values of k, f of k, goes to v over 2 pi cubed integral d3k f of k, where in the second expression k is continuous variable. This latter relation is very important because quite often in the papers on condensed matter, when people sum over momentum, or especially quasi-momentum in the first Brillouin zone, I will explain this later, they write everything in this form. But they imply that at the very end, they take thermodynamic limit and calculate this as an integral. This is probably one of the, from my point of view, when I studied condensed matter, this is one of the most important formulas in condensed matter. Yes?
So V here, that stands for like the unit volume in your configuration space?
Sorry, say it again.
Like that V there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's volume in the configuration space, right?
In the real space, yes. Yes, it's in the real space. V is equal to L cubed. V is equal to L cubed. This is very good because in the thermodynamic limit, and we always in condensed matter are interested in quantities, say specific heat, magnetization, susceptibilities, per unit volume. So in fact, people contain not sum over k, but 1 over v times sum over k. This means that we compute something per unit volume. In this case, we readily have the answer. We switch from summation to integration according to this rule. And this is used all the time. And people use interchangeable notations, either writing the sum in this form or just in this form. But thermodynamic limit is already implied. So another important thing that is of course connected to this general formula, is how delta, discrete delta function, say delta k, k prime, that is equal to delta lx, comma lx prime, delta ly, comma ly prime, delta lz, comma lz prime, can be transformed when we take the thermodynamic limit. So when L goes to infinity, or V goes to infinity equal to L squared, then it goes to 2 pi cubed divided by V delta K minus K prime, where in the right-hand side, K and K prime are now continuous variables. So to check this correspondence, one has simply to use this formula and substitute just the delta functions. Did you see delta functions in one of the previous courses? Some special functions. Okay, very, very good, yeah. So then, and this will probably our last thing. If f of k is a function of epsilon k, then we can move even further. We can compute the sum, introducing one more important concept called density of states. Sum over k of f of epsilon k going to the thermodynamic limit is equal to v over 2 pi cubed integral, and I consider three-dimensional phase space d3k f of epsilon k. So epsilon k becomes continuous here, and I will write the following in the following way, equal to v divided by 2 pi cubed integral over d3k, and use the following trick. I introduce the auxiliary variable epsilon and write d epsilon f epsilon k times delta function epsilon minus epsilon k. I just introduced artificially the new integration using delta function. And this is equal to v times d epsilon f of epsilon times d of epsilon, where d of epsilon as follows from the above definition. D of epsilon equal to 1 over 2 pi cubed d3k times delta function epsilon minus epsilon k. This function d of epsilon is called the density of states, or energy density of states, but typically people call it simply density of states. So what I did, I just simply used the definition of a delta function. So the importance of this quantity cannot be underestimated. It enters the calculation of almost all thermodynamic quantity and moreover response functions. All we need to know the energy spectrum epsilon k. So if we know the energy spectrum, we compute d of epsilon and work in a simplified way to compute thermodynamic quantities. So the density of states are not only used for free fermions, say free particles, they are used in more complicated condensed matter systems that are described by approximately free Hamiltonians. So all we need to know epsilon k. We compute d of a, and we are halfway done for the calculations of further thermodynamic quantities. So as an exercise, during last 5 minutes, let's compute the density of states for our spectrum of free particles in three dimensions. Exercise. D of epsilon 4 epsilon k equal to h squared k squared divided by 2m in 3D. So I just assume that k is a three-dimensional vector in momentum space. So let's use that definition. D of epsilon equal to 1 over 2 pi cubed d3k delta of epsilon minus h squared k squared divided by 2m. So our epsilon k depends only on the absolute value. Yes?
Yeah, sorry, I'm still a little confused by the former thing. Because you have like the integral over momentum space.
Yes.
Which means we took the limit to infinity.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
And still there's a V. What is V?
Well, V is still the volume going to infinity.
So you both took it and didn't?
Well I assume that it is, yeah, exactly. Okay, so let me do the following. Yeah. Yeah, I very very good. So we know that for the infinite systems in condensed matter, the thermodynamic quantities tend to infinity. They scale with volume. They scale with volume. So if we want to compute something per unit volume, it's better to write this way. We derive by V. By V. Because often thermodynamic, so say heat capacity for infinite thermodynamic system, they become infinite. So we have to keep this in mind all the time. All the time. And so we take thermodynamic limit. So switching from discrete values of energy to continuous, but nevertheless keep volume at the front. So, but better is to assume that there is something standing here that we compute per unit volume. In this case, we simply don't have V. Yeah, it's a little bit artificial, a little bit not very convenient. But I believe you will see this in quantum theory course as well, similar. But their wave functions are from the very beginning normalized with respect to the delta functions. Here, if you look at the expressions, I put one over square root of V, so that our wave function, it could be normalized to unity. So it's a slightly different approach from the very beginning. But anyway, let me just, we can talk about this later in more detail. So let me just finish this simple algebra that is quite nice and pleasant. So t squared depends on absolute value. So we can just write that it is 1 over 2 pi squared. Integral from 0 to infinity 4 pi k squared dk.
2 pi cubed.
Thank you very much, Oban. Thank you. Just I'm finishing soon. So delta of epsilon minus 8 bar squared k squared divided by 2m. And we use the rule how to work with the delta function of complicated variables. So the rule is the following. So let me just write 1 over 2 pi squared. So 4 cancels with h and 1 pi times integral from 0 to infinity, and I substitute k squared by 2m epsilon divided by h bar squared, and to eliminate this delta function, I just write d epsilon k divided by the absolute value d epsilon k over dk times the delta function, epsilon minus epsilon k. Right, what I did, I had initially integral over dk, but used the rule of transformation that is used in the theory of delta function to switch over integration over d epsilon k. But I must put instead the derivative here. So, and as a result of this, I have the following m divided by pi squared h bar squared 0 to infinity epsilon k d epsilon k m divided by h bar squared. Then I have 1 over, so this is just writing the derivative h squared k over m. And instead of this, I write h bar, I express k from epsilon k, I have h bar divided by 2m epsilon k. One second, epsilon minus epsilon k. Yeah, right.
Have you used m over h bar squared twice there?
Yeah. So, thank you very, very much. So, right. Epsilon k, d epsilon k, and 1 over this. So, yeah, thank you very, very much. Just I have a typo here. So, and as a result, we have m over 2 pi squared h bar cubed square root of 2m times epsilon, square root of this quantity. So we see that it is proportional to the square root of epsilon. This is our density of state. So it's non-analytic. Non-analytic because the square root of it is a non-analytic function, but there is nothing peculiar about this. So this behavior of d of epsilon determines the temperature, as we will see later, the temperature dependence of thermodynamic quantities at low temperatures. Yes.
Sorry, this is probably a silly question. Uh-huh. You see how your integration limits on zero and infinity.
From zero and infinity. So I used the integration of momentum going from Cartesian coordinates to spherical.
Yeah.
And it is only possible when epsilon k itself depends on k squared.
I see that, but my question is about integration
of
the delta function from zero to infinity. So
the delta function, so epsilon k is always positive, right?
Yeah.
It varies from zero to infinity.
Okay.
We assume that epsilon is also positive, is also positive. So, but by the way, in this formula, the density of states is equal to zero when epsilon is negative. So, and here I simply used the formula to go from the integration over k back to the integration over epsilon k.
Yeah.
That's all I did.
Thank you.
Okay, so d of epsilon is proportional to the square root of epsilon. A very special exercise, this is just the last comment where we are living, is to compute the density of states for the two-dimensional electron gas and even one-dimensional electron gas. You will see that the powers of energies will be different. And moreover, in one-dimensional case, the density of states is going to be to be singular. But there is nothing bad as long as the the singularity is integral. That's all for today, guys. If you have any questions, we can talk during lunch or whatever. Thanks.